My name is Bill Grace, and today we're going to be talking about two paradigms and talking about, more importantly, paradigm shifts. Does anybody want to hazard a guess? What's a paradigm? It's a word we talk about every once in a while, but sometimes maybe we're not exactly clued into what it means. What's a paradigm? Anybody?
A model?
Yeah, exactly. It's a model. Can you give an example?
Well, I guess democracy would be a model.
Yeah, great. Paradigm is a model that we use sometimes to describe something that's oftentimes complex. We oftentimes, for paradigms, think about metaphors that can help us take a look at, again, a complex idea or notion. And we give it a name, and that name kind of conjures up an image, and that helps us to understand something that we're talking about. What we're going to talk about this afternoon is what happens when paradigms shift, when we move from one paradigm to another, and certain things happen to us, because it's a complex sort of process. Paradigms, in addition to what was said, are models. As was said, it's a lens through which we look at the world, and we kind of see the world based on the particular lens that we're looking through. What we're going to do today is just spend about the next 5 minutes talking about paradigms, and then in general, then we're going to take a look at two specific paradigms and talk about how they affect our world. Let me just talk a little bit about paradigm shifts to begin with. There are certain things that happen in all paradigm shifts, and it's important for us to take a look at those notions first. And I'm going to try to, every time I describe something that is a part of a paradigm shift, when we move from one paradigm to another, I'm going to try to give you an example. Oftentimes, paradigms offer us fresh perspectives on things. So let me talk to you about peaches. There was a wagon train headed from the Midwest. Has anybody heard this story? Okay, wagon train heading from the Midwest, and on the wagon train they had two peach trees. And when they got to the Northwest, they planted the peach trees, and the community that brought the peach trees and planted them made a rule. And that was, because there were only two peach trees, that every person in the community could have 5 peaches a year. Okay. And that was a wise thing to do at that point in time, because peaches were scarce, and it was an important model for them to live under. Well, a couple generations passed, and one day a little girl was talking to her mother, "Mom, can I have a peach?" Well, she looked at the chart, "How many peaches have you had this year?" "Well, I've had 5. "Well, I'm sorry you've had your limit of peaches, but Mom, look at all the peaches on the ground. You know, all the peaches are going," because now they had an orchard, right? The two trees, they planted more trees off of the first two. And now there's peaches lying all over the ground. And the little girl reminds her mother that, you know, we have more peaches than we used to have. Can we change the rule? So fresh perspectives are what cause us to change paradigms. A little girl's observation that there's peaches being wasted on the ground cause us to maybe make a shift. Let me give you another example. Some of you may have heard this one. Couple were newly married, and it was the first time they were going to have Christmas dinner together. And this is not a sexist story, but let's do, you know, typical sex roles. The woman was about ready to put the roast in the oven, and just before she did, she cut off the end of the roast, threw it in the garbage, and put the rest of it in the pan, right? Now, her husband was watching this and saying, "Why did you do that?" And she said, "I don't know, my mother always used to do it, so I did it." He said, "Well, you know, it's really..." So they talked about it kind of all day, and finally she said, "Okay, I'll call my mother and find out why." So she called up and she said, "Mom, why did you used to cut off the end of the roast?" "I don't know, my mother always did it, so I did it." So they both get a conference call, right? They get on the phone to Grandma. "Grandma, why did you always cut off the end of the roast before you cooked it?" "Well, we had a small oven." you know? And it couldn't fit inside a regular roast pan, so we had to put it in a small roast pan, and we had to cut off the end of the roast, you know, so. Fresh perspective. Sometimes old models don't make sense anymore. We need fresh perspectives, okay? Yes?
I heard a really good one. Just before I left school, we were talking about getting fresh perspectives on the school I work in. And I actually saw a film that used the word paradigm. And the man in the film said he had devised a better bicycle seat.
Okay.
It had two lumpy places that were soft, where you sit down and no front hard section where
yeah.
rubs on you. And he said,
you bet.
A lot more comfortable. Why hasn't anybody thought of it?
Yeah, you know, I saw the same movie. He, you know, a bicycle, I'm a terrible artist, but, you know, most bicycle seats are shaped something like that. And he said it was really a bicycle seat just patterned after a saddle, right?
Yeah.
You know, what we did is we took a horse saddle and we just designed a different sort of horse saddle for a bicycle. And what he said is that maybe a bicycle seat ought to have a seat over here for one cheek and a seat over here for another, and nothing in between to make it a little bit more comfortable ride for men. So he's now patterning this. But again, a paradigm shift, right? The paradigm was a bicycle seat needs to be patterned after a saddle. And he's saying, no, wait a minute. Maybe there's a better model. Okay. Yeah. Excellent point. Another thing paradigms do is they most often replace the previous conception. You know, we cannot add to the concept, the world is flat. We can't add to that concept, the world is round. The world is round replaces the concept that the world is flat. Okay? So, not always, but typically, paradigms do that. They'll replace one mode of thinking for another. Paradigms usually fit better. They fit our world better. They describe things more effectively. Some of you are scientists and know more about this than me, but prior to Galileo, we had a perception of the solar system that revolved around what?
The Earth.
Now, as astronomers tried to imagine the Earth as the center of the solar system, or maybe the universe, and they follow the pattern of planets. In order for the Earth to be the center of the universe, planets had orbits like this. Tough model to believe that, you know, that planets can actually do that. Galileo started saying, wait a minute, you know, things in nature that I observe are usually simple. You know, I don't see this operating in nature. It doesn't make sense to me. Maybe something's wrong with the model. And so what he does is he puts the sun at the center of the universe, and in that model, then he begins to imagine orbits that seem more reasonable, seem more simple. So sometimes they fit better our natural world. Does this make sense? Okay. Let's learn a little bit more about paradigm shifts. They're fresh perspectives. They most often replace what we previously believed, and they fit better. Finally, I think they're more helpful. You know, Newtonian mechanics are a very, very convenient set of laws and rules that describe basically the world above the molecule. It works. F equals ma worked back in Newton's time. It still works today. Force equals mass times acceleration. You know, it's still a very good law. But on the subatomic level, it doesn't work. And so what we needed was Einstein and his theory of relativity, which is a better model that describes subatomic particles. So where am I going? This is not a science lesson. But I need to point out one thing. We're going to be talking about paradigms, the classic book in the field. We're going to get to a point in this where I think this is going to make more sense. If you want to learn more about paradigms and paradigm shifts and how it's affected our lives, all of us, I really encourage you to take a look at this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution. An awesome book that has a lot more to do with your life than you might think. In a way, it's a lot more broadly conceived than just about science. So one more time. Paradigm shifts give us fresh perspectives. They most often replace previous conceptions. They fit better. They're more helpful models to describe our world, and they cause tension, resentment, fear, confusion, etc. What did they do to Galileo? Locked him away, right? He was a heretic. How many people believed Einstein at first? You know, Newton's laws work. I see him every day. You know, who's this Einstein guy? He's crazy. You know, as Columbus was sailing off to go around the world, how many people really believed he'd come back? And, you know, when the little girl asked her mother to, if she could have more peaches, the mother's probably first reaction was a little bit of resentment. What do you mean? You know, we only get 5 peaches. Don't you know? Didn't you learn the community rules? It's not easy to urge any group towards a new paradigm. We like the models that define our world. They give us comfort. We're used to them, even if they don't fit great. We're used to them. We'd rather lock somebody away than to listen to their new idea. Okay. Well, I wanted to do a little bit of background on what are paradigms, but now I want to back up a couple steps. And I want to do a couple things. Think about this to yourself just for a moment, and then let's have a little discussion. What's your ultimate identity? Jack Nelson Palmyre asked this question of a group last week. What's your ultimate identity? Another way of asking that is, who are you, really?
But so, we need to change this.
Yeah, so we have a lot of roles in life that somehow define what we are. Yeah?
I think you're a reflection of your culture.
Yeah.
And what's around you.
Yeah, talk some more about that.
I'm not sure if I can. it's your experience, and what you are what you experience. And,
right.
You only experience what is in around you, others like you, and as long as you only experience that, you're kind of closed into a small identity.
Some people would say, you know, that we're victims of our culture, that our culture has given us certain perspectives that we haven't all the time, you know, grasped and wrestled with, maybe sometimes accepted. A slightly different twist on it, and kind of the one I was aiming you towards, is in the words of a contemporary theologian, when pressed, said, and actually, as I think about it, these are the words of Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer said, if I had to choose between Lutheran and Christian, I'd have to choose Christian. Okay? For me, if I had to choose between American and Christian, I'd have to choose Christian. And that's also a part of ultimate identity. What's your ultimate identity as you consider those choices? If you had to make a choice, what would you ultimately choose? And I just want you to be aware of that thought while we go through the next couple pieces of information. And again, I'm going backwards, now that we have an understanding of what paradigms are, I'm going backwards to set the stage of our contemporary scene in America along an important paradigm shift that I want to talk about. Okay? I want to do a real brief history, and real brief, because I don't want to bore anybody. It's late in the afternoon, and I'm tired, we're all tired, and I don't want to lose anybody. So this is a very brief history of leadership. Okay? Timeline. Back around 1900, leadership and the preparation of leaders was aimed at the great society. People responsible for leadership education were philosophers for the most part. And what their role was the preparation of people to lead us towards a great society, kind of the notion of the philosopher king or the philosopher queen, someone who really wouldn't be into material goods and could really lead a society in kind of a non-corrupt way towards towards its greatness. In about 1920, one of the beliefs shifted a little bit. We began to consider what we call trait leadership. A subtle shift, but an important one, because the focus moved from the society to the individual. We said if we wanted great societies, what we need are leaders with certain traits. And the belief is that leaders were born, not made. Well, then we get to a very important shift. Okay, the purpose for these two forms of leadership was the great society. And we have a shift in about the 1940s. And this is in response in part to the Industrial Revolution, which preceded it. The movement in leadership in the 1940s begins the notion of human relations, the belief that if we can create work groups at work that are helpful to people, people will perform better, and leaders are encouraged to become experts in human relations. Then we do something, some of you in leadership roles have heard about this, situational leadership. This is about the 1960s. And the belief is that leaders needed to be many things in many different settings, and that leaders ought to change their kind of approach and their way of thinking about a particular problem based on the people in the group. And so leaders become leaders, certain types of leaders based on the situation. And then finally, in the 1970s and 80s, we get a push towards excellence. And you've seen all the excellence literature, I'm sure. Well, an important shift happened, and one we don't think about a lot. But right around the 1940s, the people responsible for writing about leadership moved from philosophers to people concerned about business. And the bottom line changed from the great society to the dollar. Leadership from the 1940s on in this country has been based on how can we make individuals more productive, to make companies more successful, to make them more competitive. Important shift that happened, and we need to remember that. Now let me point out two different types of leadership, and as identified by a guy named James McGregor Burns, one of the leading thinkers in the area of leadership for a number of years, terrific writer. He's got a real fat book called Leadership. If you like reading about history, and you know, McBurns is just a terrific writer. I would encourage you to read that book if that's an interest of yours. He identified two types of leadership. One is transactional leadership. Transactional leadership is defined as maintaining the status quo for a chosen few. That's what we do in this culture. I've showed people the diamond model before, and I don't want to get too much into it today, but all organizations are made up of mission, power, structure, and resources. And if we look at who controls those different points of the diamond in this country, we find out that, without getting into too much detail again, that for the most part, white males control mission, power, structure, and resources. And Robert Terry calls this a club. And the club is really aimed at meeting the needs of serving, if you will, white males who are the status quo. So managers, under this new system of leadership, which has as its bottom line the dollar, trains people to maintain the status quo for a chosen few. Transformational leadership, which James McGregor Burns believes that our society needs, changes the status quo for the common good. Okay? And I'm going to suggest to you that transformational leaders, when they're at their best, change our paradigms, change our models. That's what Galileo did. Okay? That's what Einstein did. That's what the little girl did, who asked why couldn't she have more peaches? That's what Columbus and Magellan and other visionaries during the expansionist era talked about. Let me stop there and make sense, because I'm trying to connect three things. The notion of paradigms with the history of leadership, and connect that then to two different types of leadership. Does this make sense? Any questions?
Have you got a couple of quick examples of people that would fit your second category?
Transformational leaders? You bet. Martin Luther King looked at a situation, and in his speech, he said, someday, I can picture a tomorrow where little white boys and little white girls hold hands with little black boys and black girls, and we really live out the true meaning of our creed, that all people are created equal. Beautiful speech, and where he calls us to transform basically to what we said we've always been. But he just asks us in that case to kind of live out the dream. You know, he creates a new paradigm for us, though, in his I Have a Dream speech. And I'd say Gandhi as well. You know, Gandhi begins to help the people of India to see that they can be independent from British rule. And that's a new model for people, that people in India not perceiving themselves as capable of being independent, and Gandhi indicating that they can, and what's more, they can do it nonviolently. So those are two people who come to mind for me. Another one, on another level, I guess, is Rosa Parks, who switched the paradigm that said, that somehow blacks are less important than whites, just because she just refused to give up her seat on the bus. She began, what was a transformational movement carried on by King and others, but she was really the spark. So there's different levels of transformational leadership too. Does that make sense? Okay. Let me just do one last thing. Picture those people I just mentioned, and other transformational leaders have come to mind for you. We talked about Galileo, King, Gandhi. What typically happens to transformational leaders? What happens to them?
They try to kill them.
Yeah, why?
Because they don't want to change.
You're messing up my world, right? You're messing up my world. I'm fine, the way I see the world right now, it seems to be working for me. Why are you trying to tell me that the world is different? I like the thought that planets go like this, because I like the thought that the Earth is the center of the universe. Transformational leaders are rejected and sometimes assassinated. Christ, in my mind, is a transformational leader. What he believed was that somehow life was more powerful than death, that love was more powerful than the law. I think that's what God was trying to teach us in the life of Christ, and really caused a paradigm shift. Most people in Christ's day really didn't know what he had done. I love this little story. I collect stories like this. And I hope this doesn't offend anyone's faith, but it's kind of an understanding of Christ that I really appreciate. It also puts the pressure on us. After Christ had ascended into heaven and completed his role on earth, he was up in heaven and some of the angels were talking to him and patting him on the back. Nice job down there, super job. What exactly did you do down there? He said, well, good question. He said, I started the church. Oh, what's the church? Well, I've got these 12 men back on earth and several real inspired women, and they've promised me that they're going to go out and tell people the story of my life, and it's going to change the world. Well, what's your plan if that doesn't work? I don't have another one. We're it. Okay? Paradigm shifts. That's what we're talking about. Don't let me tell too many stories. I get take me off the subject here. Okay. All right. So, I want to talk about one specific paradigm shift that I think we're on the verge of. Now, I'm trying to act like this here. And so if your first instinct is to reject this paradigm, I'm kind of prepared for that. Okay? But let me share this paradigm with you, and I want you to help me make sense of it. here's the paradigm. Let's say that we're all on a boat together. It could be the love boat. We're all having a great time. It's our first cruise for all of us. And we've had several nights at sea, no big problems. And then there was a storm at sea. And the beautiful boat that we were all on capsized and sunk. But thanks to God, we all made it out into different lifeboats. Okay? Talking about lifeboat here as a paradigm. So here's all these lifeboats out there in the water. Call this lifeboat A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L. Okay? Now, as it happened, it was such a panic, we all just jumped into different lifeboats. We had no idea what lifeboat we were jumping into. And provisions were thrown into lifeboats in kind of a haphazard way as well. So in lifeboat A, people who got into lifeboat A found that there was plenty of food, plenty of water. They had a radio, sunscreen, tarps, cassettes, music. More rations and more water than they had people. As a matter of fact, half the amount of people got into lifeboat A than what the boat was capable of carrying. Okay? Lifeboat B, a few more people get in. They had a little less food, a little less water. They had sunscreen. They had a radio, but the batteries were going dead. Okay? You see where I'm going. Lifeboat D didn't have as much food, didn't have as much water. We get down to lifeboat L. Those of us that got on lifeboat L, dumb choice. But, you know, it was dark. We couldn't see. No water. Excuse me. No food. Plenty of water. No radio. No sunscreen. Tough lifeboat to be in. Lifeboat to be in. So, lifeboat L realizes that somewhere up there, you know, folks are living better. And what's more, we're all in the same boat to begin with, so they decided they're going to paddle over here and talk to lifeboat A. Hey, folks, how about throwing over some sunscreen? No way! If you were smart enough to get into a good lifeboat, you'd have sunscreen. It's not my fault that you were stupid to get into the dumb lifeboat, you know? So forget it. Well, how about some food? No way! You know, we don't know how long we're going to be out here. We're going to have to survive, too. My kids are on board. I don't know how long we're going to have to be out here in the ocean. Too bad. This, I think, is a model, if you're, and some of you are already seeing it, is a model of the nation states. Okay? This is our current perception of countries in the world. Some folks have a lot of provisions. Some hardly have any. People with a lot of provisions deserve them. To people without many provisions, you know, if they were only like us and smart, they would have got into a good lifeboat. But who really knew? I mean, it was dark, right? Who really knew? We happened to be born into this culture. I didn't plan to be in this culture. I was born into this culture. People who are in this culture didn't plan to be into this culture. They were born into this culture. Unequal distribution of resources based on chance, for the most part, results in some tension. Now let's say that we're out at sea for a couple weeks. Let's use this paradigm. If paradigms work, if they describe our world, if they're useful models, then we ought to be able to predict some behavior. So let me ask you a couple questions. Can you use this paradigm model to explain the third world infant mortality rate? Anybody want to give it a shot? I see a head nodding back there. Use this model to explain infant mortality rate.
I think It occurs because the people are in the wrong lifeboat. They are accidentally in that place.
And they didn't have the medical supplies, right?
Yeah, of course.
Or the food?
Yeah.
Or the health care? Or the as a matter of fact, I forgot to tell you that three times as many people got into Lifeboat L as were supposed to. Mm-hmm. Okay? Someone used this paradigm model to explain terrorism. Anybody want to try to explain terrorism using this model? Yeah. Are you poised with your hand?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, if I'm in hell and I've got a chance, I'm going to try to get what A has got.
Yeah.
You know. Is A armed here? You never told us whether they had any way to fend off.
Okay. Let's pick up on that one. Somebody used this model to explain the defense budget. Okay? Does that make sense? Here we are. Let's all say that we're in Lifeboat L for a second. You know? And our leader back there says, folks, you know, 2 weeks ago, I remember, you know, we were all dancing together on the Lido deck, having a great time. Some of those people over there I was playing cards with, hey, we're brothers and sisters, you know? Who says that they have more right to those supplies than we do? Let's do something. So paddle over. Hey, how about sharing the resources? No way, forget it. So we kind of paddle back to where it's safe and we can talk. We say, hey, what do you want to do? What can we do to get their attention? So somebody says, well, you know, I've got this steak knife. Why don't we paddle over and threaten to put a hole in their lifeboat? Okay? So we find out where they're vulnerable and we try to get their attention. Is terrorism a means of third world individuals? Not all terrorism is third world related, but is it the have-nots really trying to get our attention and say, hey, wait a minute, there's something very wrong here in this picture, and you're not listening to us, you're ignoring us, you know, your earphones are on, you can't hear us, you're too busy putting on the sunscreen. Listen, and we'll do what's necessary to save our children's lives to get your attention. Yeah.
You might even take this a little farther to your Lifeboat A, and picking up kind of what Jack's been talking about this week, you might even go and sink one of the Lifeboat L to make sure that these other lifeboats aren't going to get near you to challenge your resources.
If Lifeboat A, excellent point, doesn't respond to Lifeboat L in a way that quiets them, this is what happens when you confront Lifeboat A, folks. We got it, and we deserve it. And you try to take it away from us, let this be a lesson.
You might also find a leader in each of those other lifeboats that would be, you could help into a position where they would benefit some in order to...
Okay, so pay off governments. Hey, you know, who's the leader over here? What boat is this? What's before L?
Okay.
Okay. Somebody's good at doing the alphabet backwards. Okay, so let's find the leader over here. Come over at night while everybody else is asleep. Psst, psst. You know, hey, we've got some extra rations and here's a little bit of sunscreen. You keep these people under control. One of the things you can tell them is that God loves poor people, you know? And if they're all quiet, you know, and don't do anything, you know, if they die out in the open sea, they're going to heaven anyway. You know, just keep telling them that story. And in the meanwhile, you know, we'll keep you in good shape.
Another possibility might be that A might want something that K or L might have. And the question that you posed earlier about infant mortality made me think about some of our capitalistic companies peddling infant formula to third world countries without the possibility of them supporting that.
Now, yeah, I mean, we could make up all kinds of scenarios that, you know, this boat here doesn't have a lot, but what it does have is something that A needs. And so we could create all kinds of scenarios. But the belief in our nation state model is that the unequal distribution of resources is okay. It's God's plan. And what's more, people in healthy lifeboats have the right to those resources. And the people in some of the other lifeboats, that's God's plan too. And they'll just need to learn to live with that because that's the way the world is. I asked you earlier, what's your ultimate identity? If I pushed you, what would you choose? American or Christian? And I'm about to push you.
Are those the only two choices?
Not necessarily. That's a very good question. But let me, in light of that question, nonetheless push you, and I wrote on this board with the wrong marker. But there's a solvent that'll take it off, so what am I going to do? I will
use the blackboard.
Use the blackboard. Thank you. Okay, lifeboat. There's one paradigm. The next paradigm I'd like you to consider. Here's the first time I heard about Spaceship Earth. I think that the right person to credit for this understanding or this name is R. Buckminster Fuller. I could be wrong. My first impression of Spaceship Earth, though, is this. It was one of the missions, I think one of the Apollo missions, and there from the moon, they took this glorious picture of what they called an Earthrise. You know, the Earth came into view over the lunar horizon, and they snapped this beautiful picture of this, what we've called the blue marble out in space. Here around this dark void is this beautiful blue planet. You know, other planets are yellow and red and seem lifeless, and here's this beautiful planet. And, you know, traveling through the universe, kind of like a spaceship, and it's Spaceship Earth. And one of the things that the astronauts reported that was phenomenal to them is that boundaries disappeared. I mean, they looked down at the Earth, and where were the boundaries? Where did the United States end and Mexico begin? They weren't sure. You know, if somebody wanted to study satellite photos, I'm sure that we have people who could interpret them and tell you exactly where the boundary was and probably exactly where you live. But taking a holistic view, the question was, where did the boundaries exist anymore? And were we a whole system? Things like acid rain, for instance, help us to perceive that we're a whole system, that burning fossil fuel in northern United States causes acid rain in Canada, that the Chernobyl nuclear accident causes strontium-90 to be put in the atmosphere and affects the cattle, affects the dairy industry in Western Europe. We really are one system. What I'm suggesting to you is that Spaceship Earth, because of environmental deterioration, because the fact that the environment, the winds, the seas really don't know national boundaries, and because the unequal distribution of resources are the source of most of our problems in the world, my opinion, they cause territorialism, they cause us to build up defense systems, they cause, we could trace notions like terrorism and puppet governments back to them. What would happen if leaders, transformational leaders, decided that Spaceship Earth was the new paradigm and it didn't make sense anymore to think about the lifeboat model? How would our lives be different? One of my experiences when I was between undergraduate and graduate school, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So for 7 months, I put on a backpack and I traveled by plane and by bus and by horse and by, you know, my thumb, and traveled to 5 different continents and a whole bunch of different countries. And as I reflect on my journal every once in a while, and I don't do it as often as I used to, one of the things I was really startled by back then was that people all over the world I got along great with. It was the systems of government that I had some difficulty with. When I went to Russia, I knew I was in an oppressive state. I mean, no one had to tell me that the American way of life, the American way of government, openness and democracy was not a better way to live. It absolutely is. But it also was clear to me that a lot of people in Russia, this was back in 1975, wanted that. and that it would, I predicted in my journal that it wouldn't be long before there would be some sort of change. I wasn't smart enough to think of the word perestroika. If I was, I'd be, rich by now, probably. But that concept hit me, that people all over the world, I got along great with. Some people I met, we didn't hit it off. But some people I meet in my neighborhood, we don't hit it off. But there were people all over the world that I got along just fine with. And I used to be afraid of that. When I was traveling in Turkey, I had all of these images of what Turkey was like. Somebody's going to put drugs into my bag and I'm going to get arrested for trying to smuggle drugs across the border. People from Turkey carry big, long, curved knives, and if I fall asleep, they're going to kill me. I love Turkey. The Turkish people were so gracious and hospitable to me. It's one of my favorite memories in my travels. All over the world, people broke down my model, my paradigm, that somehow Americans were ugly and would be mistreated. Now, I was surprised, since I was here and they were here in some of the countries I visited, why they didn't resent me, but somehow they didn't. And my only answer, my only response to that is somehow there's a magic in human relations that if humans want to have a relationship and interrelate on a positive, productive, sister-like, brother-like level, we can. Well, I'm beginning to preach as opposed to teach, so I'm going to stop preaching. I'm going to ask you, if you would, if there are no other questions, just to turn to, let's say, three other people. So we do this in groups of four. And I'm going to put some questions on the board, some of which are the following. Compare and contrast the two paradigms, lifeboat and spaceship Earth. Going back to some of these notions, which model is more helpful? Which fits better with your ultimate identity? What is your ultimate identity? Which model fits better with your ultimate identity? We're going to talk about what do we risk by changing paradigms, what do we gain, and then we'll see where we're at in group discussions. I'll put those questions up somewhere, and why don't you get into those groups of four now, and we'll begin that. First question, you can begin doing that. Just compare and contrast the two paradigms, okay? Okay, let's get back together. We're running out of time quickly, so let's get back in the large group. Okay, let's try to hear a little bit from each group. I'm not on hold in time, but I think I have 4:45. Is it 4:45 exactly. Hold in time?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so we've got about 5 minutes. Okay, if you'd like, typically they're supposed to be an hour, but if you'd like, we can let this go for the next, 15, 20 minutes if you want. Let's talk a little bit about some of these questions. And if we could, let's try to hear from, each of the groups. Any compare and contrast the models? Anybody have some insights? I mean, we did a lot of that. Anybody want to share some unique insights that came up in your group?
Take out the word unique.
Okay. All right. Why don't you share some insights that came up in your group?
That we certainly can't go with the lifeboat, but there's a lot of risk in going with the other. And it probably has to be a step-by-step process.
Okay.
I suggest we annex Mexico to start with.
Okay, interesting comment there. I think we need to dwell on that for a bit.
We live in Southern California, and the problem is so real there, where we're pushing people back across the border every night.
Okay.
Okay, let's welcome
every
them.
Day. They come across the night.
The notion is that what I'm hearing from what you said is that the spaceship Earth model, or let me put it differently, the lifeboat model is not working. Your group identifies that. And we need to move to something else. And spaceship Earth sounds like a leap of faith, doesn't it? You know, and so how are we going to get there? But where we're at is not maybe the best place to be. Good observation.
We were talking about the fact that people seem to like their lifeboats, even the ones without a lot to eat or drink. And I think one of the evidences of that is now that the Russian Empire is breaking up, the first thing that became clear was that this thing that had seemed like a cohesive society very quickly got into their own very
okay.
identifiable lifeboats and marked out who they were. And,
okay, so what you're saying, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is that people's cultural traditions
yes.
really have a great deal of meaning for them, that the way in which a Hungarian celebrates life,
yes.
lives life, you know, the way a Hungarian funeral is maybe different than a Czechoslovakian funeral. You know, I grew up Irish and Italian, you know. Irish and Italians did things differently. And both had a lot of history and tradition. So I think one of the questions you're raising is maybe there's some good in the lifeboat, the cultural tradition, but how do we get away from the disproportional distribution of income?
Yeah.
Knowing that maybe some of that cultural diversity, no matter what model we go to, we ought to preserve. Okay, excellent point.
Well, we started kind of approaching this as, you know, which one are we going to choose? And with the idea that, okay, if we're in lifeboat at A, that's well and good, that so who cares if all the rest of the lifeboats sink? We're still there. But that paradigm breaks down, because if all these other lifeboats sink, I mean, is the ocean going to go away? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It's not a reality anymore. I mean, we are in the spaceship, you know, whether we like it or not, that we have to shift the paradigm.
Fit better. You know, Galileo's notion that, you know, wait a minute, is the Earth really the center of the universe? You know, we have to kind of distort the truth, don't we, in order to have that paradigm fit. We have to have the planets do these weird orbits in order to claim that to be the truth. So what you're saying is that the truth really is, I mean, let's just look around us. We are on a spaceship Earth, and we don't have these identifiable lifeboats that really are not interconnected. We are interconnected. You know, and what you're saying is that...
you puncture one, you puncture them all.
Okay. All right. Excellent point.
Someone said that the Earth has become a neighborhood because of communication.
Okay.
But not a brotherhood.
Great point. The Earth has become a neighborhood, but not a brotherhood. Brotherhood and sisterhood. Excellent point. Okay? Yeah, Hans.
We got into a step towards spaceship Earth by thinking about the European Economic Union, where they have countries of considerably different wealth somehow heading toward working together in an economy which wasn't a communist, an idealistic communistic society where everyone would be automatically equal, but different countries would bring different strengths and weaknesses to the total economy, and somehow, I'm not sure how it's going to work, but they were going to somehow work together. And thought of that as at least a mini model in the right direction.
Okay. You know, little steps forward. What happens to world security when we make those steps forward? Somebody said, you know, right now if we look at it, people in Northern Europe own a great deal of New York City. Japan owns a great deal of Los Angeles. You know, picture a world war now. What does Japan have to lose by dropping bombs in California? Their assets. You know, when we break down the notion of nation state and we become a global family, it's more difficult to participate in kind of national competition in the context of war. It leaves us with the problem of how do we learn to settle conflicts in ways other than war. Conflicts arise. We need, one of the new models we need is our new models for conflict resolution. You know, my family, which I happen to think is a terrific family, you know, we have conflicts on a daily basis, you know. And if we don't have anything to fight about, you know, we usually make something up just because we like doing it so much. But, you know, conflict is a normal and natural process. So what are some new paradigms? What are some new models for resolving conflict on a global scale? How will we do that? It's going to happen, right? And what it appears now is that America, as of a week ago, is number two in terms of national economic power. Japan is now number one. How do we get used to that as a nation? Do we need to be number one in order to be a happy people? And can we spread the wealth further? You know, and hold it. I'm constantly reminded by the fact that nobody makes more than anybody else. You know, everybody, no matter if you're a maverick or a carpenter or a waitry, housekeeper, teacher, you know, painter, everybody has the same meal. Everybody has about the same lodging. You know, somehow we're a community. You know, and we all do different things. Good observations. I don't know if we've heard from the groups over here.
One idea we started talking about that didn't get very far on is that selfish interests will be best served if the spaceship model can be adopted. Because,
interesting.
With a longer-term perspective, you see that nothing is going to survive.
Okay. There's a great observation, long-term perspective. I got to tell a little story on that. If it turns too long, let me know. There was Akio Morita, the chairperson of Sony Corporation. You know, he's new money. He's one of the more infamous kind of capitalists in Japan. But he's really new money, and he's really not connected to the old money in Japan, and therefore the prestige. And there's a little group in Japan, I can't remember what it's called right now, that he's trying to get in good with, you know, but he's a multimillionaire, but he's still new money, and, you know, they're holding him at a distance. Well, one of the things you need to get in to do to get into this group is to really become, you know, a proponent of Japanese culture and a critic of Western culture. So Akio Morita, about 6 months ago, wrote a paper in Japanese aimed for this group of conservative Japanese citizens in order to kind of buy his way into this exclusive club. Well, somebody once said the world community is changing, communication is happening. It didn't take very long for that article written in Japanese to get translated and to get smuggled into the United States, and it was the hottest thing on college campuses among economic professors a couple months ago. Who could get a copy of this paper? And as it was translated, the title was The Japan That Can Say No. That was the title of it, The Japan That Can Say No. And here's what the basic premise was, is that Japan knows how to say no to short-term gains, and the United States doesn't. Case in point, Nabisco Corporation. The person that formed the Nabisco Corporation liked cookies and believed that one of the best things they could do for the country was to make a good cookie. And that was Nabisco's role in life, was to make breakfast products and cookies that we'd all like.